Blog Talk Radio.
Transformed is an audio production of Speculist Media. You can find us online at worldtransformed.com. This program explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. The World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you doing?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I am great. Doing great. Got a good show lined up for this evening again. We're looking forward to it.
Well, you know, we were just looking at some of the competition, some of the other shows that are on live right now on Blog Talk Radio. We saw the one with the lady who is a wrestler and a model, so we're on against that. And then there's a guy who wrote a book. It's called The Man from 2063. I shouldn't be promoting these other shows. Well, what the heck? We don't care. Called The Man from 2063 about, I guess, it's a 100-year reflection on the assassination of JFK. Actually, that sounds kind of interesting. I'm going to go listen to that on archive later.
Yeah, I'll go listen to the archive copy of that, you know, when we're done here. So that's
what we're up against. But as I said right before the show started, the real brain trust of the Blog Talk Radio listening audience is going to be right here with us tonight, because we are doing part two of the future of isms. And you know, I think that the suspense has been building ever since we did part one a couple of weeks ago. You know, everybody wants to hear what are these 50 other isms, and you know, what's the future of them going to be. I was listening to our part one show earlier this week. I was out riding on my bicycle and listening to it. And, you know, we had gone into it. I had high hopes that we were going to get through all 100 isms in 90 minutes. And you were pretty skeptical on that point.
Very much so. Very much so. I just, you know, I know us. I know that we like, you know, you give it, you know, we can take two or three subjects, Phil, and fill an hour with it, you know. You give us 50 subjects and even, you know, kind of try to put us on a timer or something, we're still going to chase rabbits a little bit. So I just didn't feel there was any possibility. And on this occasion, I was correct. So,
Stephen, you can spin this. You can wrap this any way you want, spin it any way you want, perfume it any way you want. Your negativity brought us down, okay? That's all there is to it, all right? I thought we could do it. You didn't think we could. And lo and behold, we couldn't do it. There's no other way of looking at this.
It was your
pessimism. I think it was your, if you don't mind my saying, your malism, the belief that the world is evil. Well, you don't have that belief. I'm not going to throw that one at you.
Well, that's our first one. Last week was what was our last one last week? It was libertarianism.
Libertarianism. We had a good discussion of libertarianism, I think, and we're all set now for malism. We're going to jump right into them so that we have plenty of time to do all of them. And that is, in fact, the belief that the world is evil. I think that no. I think that that one's not got that great of a future. There's too many other good candidates for things that people can call evil these days. I don't think the world gets to be evil as much as it did back in the day. There will still be some people who hold that belief, but I don't think it's I don't think in the future it's going to be as big as it has been in the past.
You know, there's a kind of a it's got a long history in you know, Western civilization and things like that. Basically, you know, the idea of the fallen world. There'd be a flavor of malism that, you know, the world is bad, but we're able to make it better. You know, maybe something like that. But I don't think that's really what malism really is. I think that
it generally leads to renunciation.
Pretty much, you know,
of the world.
Everything sucks, and it's just a depressing ism actually to start with tonight. But we're just going to say, nah, it doesn't have much of a future.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Let's jump on. Let's move on. We got lots of big ones to hit here, so we'll not spend too much time on
materialism.
Materialism,
I would say, that's of course the belief that matter is the only extant substance in the universe. Well, you know what? I when I look at materialism, I have a whole different definition in my mind. But I guess
What's your
materialism?
Definition?
You
mean like people liking material things and being materialistic?
Yeah,
that sort of thing.
Madonna had a song about it, it seemed like.
That's right.
but actually, this materialism is just that matter is the only substance of that matters in the universe. There's no spiritual side to the universe or anything like that.
It's the opposite of mysticism, I would think, yeah.
Yeah, it's you know what's here is all that matters. No, the problem with materialism, if that's your definition, is that, what is matter, you know? The more that physicists look at matter, the more it looks like information. And matter and energy are interchangeable. We've already learned that from Einstein. So, I think materialism, as defined that way, would have some trouble. I think... maybe there's a flavor of atheism that might take that as, you know, this world is the only world that, and there's no spiritual side of things. They might have some.
Oh, yeah, they go hand in hand, absolutely. Materialism and atheism go hand in hand. And that's why I would say that right now materialism is having a real renaissance. It's having a boom time for materialism right now, along with atheism. We talked about atheism last week, or week before last. And I think that you're right. It probably stalls a little bit. At the rate we're going, everybody would be a materialist before too long. Everybody would be an atheist before too long. Just kind of at the rate those two are growing. But I don't think that happens. In the case of materialism, I don't think it happens for the exact reason you said. What is matter? We've got this really interesting relationship between information and matter that we haven't quite figured out yet. And I also think there's an interesting difference between matter and processes. I think that there are like things that happen which are different from matter, and that distinction isn't clearly made and clearly understood, and that becomes a lot more important probably in the future. So I think materialism, as it's understood today, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, but it starts breaking into some other really interesting discussions about what it all means. But we'll get to mysticism and spiritualism later and see if they also have some kind of a future. And oh, spoiler, they do. So let's move on.
Well,
meliorism.
I want to say one more thing about materialism before we move on. Materialism, as we typically think of materialism, I think has an interesting future. When you've got things like 3D printers, and you've got maybe at some point a nanofactory, materialism, you know, you end up with people that have sort of the Star Trek mentality. Oh, we're better than folks that, we're worried about money and material, you know. Well, yeah, of course, when you can say Earl Grey hot, Mr. Picard, you're going to be beyond that. But the rest of us have to work for a living. Anyway, that's
true. You know, it's what Madonna said, right? We're living in a material world, and she's a material girl, right? If you don't have
right now, we're living very much in a material world.
Yeah, you got to focus a lot of energy and attention on it if you don't have it, so you can get it. But if you can have anything you want, anytime you want, you can actually be a lot less materialistic, at least the way we think of the term. You know, you really don't have to focus on the material all that much. It's like if you want something, you say Earl Grey hot and it shows up. And then, yes, you can be like Picard and you can be very snooty and look down on people who had to work for it like we do, right? So I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, sometimes we make do with Earl Grey lukewarm. But anyway,
that's right. Lipton lukewarm.
We like it.
Lipton sun tea, left it out too long, things like that. Absolutely. Yes.
Exactly.
Well, okay, we got to move quickly here.
Meliorism,
the belief that the world tends to become better. I don't use this term, but I am a meliorist. I think of myself as an optimist. This isn't a term I use, but I actually believe that the world tends to become better. To me, this is a core tenet of what I call the human imperative, that we're constantly working on improving our own circumstances, and as a result, we make the world better and better. But if you even take the human imperative out of the equation, if you look at things like Kurzweil's law of accelerating returns, we seem to live in a universe that, as a matter of course, provides greater complexity and greater opportunities for information, for good things to happen. So it feels like there is a tendency for the world to become better, or at least some of us are fairly convinced that it is. I think this is kind of a new idea in the world. There's always been the belief that the golden age was sometime in the past, and that there might be maybe some utopia in the future when everything else gets wiped out and we destroy all this mess that we're in. But the notion that things just sort of tend to get better and better and better, I think that's a relatively new idea, and I think it's going to have some shelf life. I think that it's just starting to catch on. I think people are only just beginning to become aware of this, and that it's going to be bigger in the future.
Yeah, and particularly if we're right about the trajectory of history, it's got this particular ism has a great future. Okay, mentalism, the belief that the world can be explained as an aspect of I'm having a little trouble reading this, Bill. I'm sorry.
Of the mind.
Of the mind. Okay.
What
do you say, Bill, on this one?
Well, to me, this runs into like subjectivism, the notion that perhaps we're just imagining it all, or that perhaps our minds are creating it, and there are aspects of quantum physics that suggest this. I think that probably the role of consciousness in defining the universe, and maybe less grandiosely, just kind of defining our own subjective experience, or the role of subjective experience in terms of what's really happening, we're going to be paying a lot more attention to that in the future. So I think this one has probably got some legs, and we'll see a greater interest in mentalism in the future. I don't think we'll use that term, though, because there's that show on CBS, right, The Mentalist, and this sounds like that, right? It sounds like the practice of faking people out with mind tricks, and that's really not what they're talking about.
Okay. All right. I got another one. It's going to be a little hard to pronounce here.
Millenarianism. Millenarianism.
Okay.
Belief that the ideal society will be produced in the near future. What do you think, Stephen?
Yeah. Well, this is sort of you kind of alluded to this and just a second ago. This is the idea that the utopia is just right around the corner.
Right.
In a way, I suppose that you could say that those who believe in the idea of the singularity are a little bit that way.
They are accused of being that, aren't they? They're accused of being kind of the modern version of that, yeah.
Yeah. And our defense, because we believe that the singularity is a likely scenario, we say, well, you know what? We still believe that post singularity, the beings, the people that are in that world, will still believe they have problems. It'll be much different from ours, but we're not saying that it'll be this world with no problems at all. It's just it'll be a much, much different and I think better world.
Yeah, you know, this term ties into the millennium. That's its root.
Yeah.
And the idea is that people got, you know, as we approached the year 2000, there was more and more of this, we're hitting, you know, dawning of the age of Aquarius. We're about to hit the new age. We're about to hit the new thing that's going to change everything. And because it's occurring roughly in that time frame, people will accuse the singularity of being just another species of that. But I actually think that it has absolutely nothing to do with the millennium. I think the belief that the awesome new time is upon us, or that the dreadful, horrible thing we've always, you know, feared, that time is upon us. I just think those are twin ideas that we carry inside of us as human beings. I just think that's something
that
it's
always been thus. Yes, I mean,
yeah,
we've always
yeah.
had that.
Yeah, and I think wherever we are in time, we're gonna have millenarianism. I think that it's gonna be with us, and we're gonna have doomsayers no matter what, no matter how good things get. In fact, the better they get, I think the more pronounced our doomsayers will probably become. Okay, next comes monism, the belief that all things can be placed in one category, and this is in contrast to dualism. We talked about dualism last time. And we said that dualism, I think, is going to stick around. And I think monism is, too. I think, along with materialism and atheism, monism is one of the hallmarks of rational thinking, scientific thinking, and the belief that there is just, you know, one set of physical laws that controls everything, that everything can be reduced to a set of mathematical equations. That idea has profoundly taken a hold of our civilization, and I think it's not going anywhere. I think that that monism will be a very big idea for many years to come. I think dualism will stick around and will continue to challenge it, and what the duality is will continue to be redefined as we go forward, just as it has in the past. I think when we talked about it a couple weeks ago, we were saying dualism was talking about good and evil, and nowadays when they talk about dualism, it's less theological, less moral, and they're talking more about mind and matter. And in the future, the dualism may be something else completely. It might be matter and information. I don't know. But I think that as big as monism gets, there will always be some dualistic alternative that will be offered to it.
Well, it could be something as simple as, well, there's both hardware and software. You know, I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Brain, you know, we have a mind, but that is the result of the brain. You know, I mean, The two concepts are so closely related that the dualists and the monists are closer than maybe they realize. Okay, monotheism, the belief in only one God. When mankind first began to believe in higher powers, that's probably at the very dawn of us being people. It was a there was gods everywhere. There was gods, you know, rocks, trees, sun, moon, that idea gradually got replaced in the world with the idea of one God for everything. And the atheists would argue that, well, we're the next step, and it's just one less God than that. But I would say that monotheism has a bright future. It's gonna, and that idea will hold on and continue to hold on.
We'll continue to believe in, at the most, one God, right? And certainly no more than one.
I don't think that polytheism will necessarily have to see a resurgence, but who knows? Okay, mysticism.
Okay, so this is a belief that there's something transcendent, something beyond what we can access through reason, through our senses, and you know, that there is some mystical realm, some spiritual realm, and you know what, this is not going anywhere. Mysticism will take new forms. It always takes new forms. It will continue to do that. But I think it would be silly to think that it's going to disappear altogether. I think that that probably materialism is going to continue to grow, but it will be countered by different forms of mysticism, different variations of mysticism, and some really interesting new varieties related to technology and related to new things that we've learned. But I don't think it's going anywhere.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we've chased mysticism out of a lot of aspects of our lives, but there's still some mysteries that that we have. The mystery of consciousness is a big one. You know,
we think
like every third, fourth show we end up talking at length about that mystery. And as long as there's things like that, I mean, there's room for mysticism in the world, and that's I agree. It's that one will stick around. As will the next one, I think, which is narcissism, excessive self-love, self-obsession. Of course, it's named for Narcissus, I believe.
Narcissus, yeah. He was. What was he? Was he a god or a nymph or what was he? Yeah, something.
I forget. My son, who's a kind of a loves that kind of stuff, would be able to tell me. But
anyway, Greek mythology. He was in. Oh wait, maybe he might have just been a dude, but he was in love with.
I think he was a normal guy, but.
He was so beautiful, or a goddess, or something.
He was maybe he was a demigod or something because he was so beautiful. He fell in love with his reflection and in the water.
Oh, that's right. Echo was in love with him. That's right. He wasn't in love with anybody but himself. Yeah, he saw his own reflection and fell in love with himself and froze
and
in place.
And actually, like starved to death or something as a result of he wouldn't look away from his own reflection. So
I haven't looked down to the S's. Do we get to solipsism at some point? Okay, we do. Yeah, see, okay, technology enables a greater focus on the self than we've ever had before. You can make the world all about you in a way that you never have been able to before. So, yeah, I think that that both narcissism and solipsism are they're just in their dawning days here. I think they're going to get a lot bigger than they currently are, that incredibly self-centered narcissistic behavior, or what would seem that to us today, is going to be pretty broad, pretty widespread in the near future.
I would argue that yes, that's true, but the opportunity for involvement with others will be magnified as well. So, whichever direction you want to go in, I think technology will. If you just want to be completely obsessed with yourself, I think technology would help you in that. As would allowing you to plug into others as well. So, okay, next is nationalism.
Now, nationalism is typically meant to mean kind of like narcissism. It's like an obsessive love of country, right? An over, like, focus, being overly fixed on one's own nation. I'm actually going to redefine nationalism here, and I'm going to use it to simply mean thinking that the concept of nations is a meaningful one, that it's even an important one. And I think even that idea is probably going to be challenged. Certainly the old idea of nationalism, I think, is waning. We're living in an increasingly global world, and people are still fiercely loyal to their nations. I don't mean to suggest that they're not. But we also feel terribly connected to people in other places and people who aren't part of our nation that in a way that we never did before, in a way that it would have been very difficult to have done before. And I think even the idea of nations, nation states, the idea that that's an important division, I think potentially starts to go away, that we might start to look at those the way we do time zones or, latitude or longitude or something like that. It's like, it's an interesting piece. It's something that you know about, yourself, and you might take a certain amount of pride in it because there's some heritage there. But ultimately, as we turn into a more global civilization, nationalism, I think wanes and starts to fade, or perhaps not. What do you think, Stephen?
I think so. I think that the idea just the importance of nations, I think, begins to fade as the power of individuals rises. I don't think there's much way to short circuit that. Although it seems like we've seen an effort to centralize power in the last few years here in our own country. I think that ultimately that's sort of a last ditch, effort on the part of those who would do that.
Because that has occurred, I don't think that Americans have typically become more nationalistic, though, right?
Yeah.
I don't see anywhere in the political spectrum people becoming more nationalistic. Progressives would accuse conservatives of being more nationalistic than they are, but I don't think that anyone is more so than they used to be. You know what I mean? Right. And you get into the whole, am I a nationalist or a patriot? And, you know, we're not gonna argue any of that stuff. But the concept itself, I think, is a lot less important. How about nativism?
The belief
that the mind possesses inborn thoughts. Well, you know what? I've known that was false since the day I was born. How's that?
I love that, Bill. That's great. Nativism is just a little bit like what our instincts are, I guess. I think that we pretty much have proven science.
Yeah, there's information in our brains when we're born.
We're all set up for language. You know, I mean, it's we don't have to completely decode, and we don't have to invent language to learn language as a child. Our brains are already set up for it. There's other things as well. You know, you take an infant and they put an infant on this glass plane, Phil, where it looks like there's a drop off,
mm-hmm.
you know, right underneath the glass. And, you know, just tiny little babies, they get too close to that drop-off and they start crying. It scares them. And,
okay, that's a mean thing to do to little babies. All
right. Yeah, it's a very mean thing. But, it's interesting because babies have an inborn idea that I could fall, even if they've never fallen in their life.
There's information in our brains when we're born, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I think it's proven, and it's just... naturalism is next. It's the belief that the world can be explained in terms of natural forces. What do you think?
Okay,
Bill?
Once again, this is part of a complex, right? Along with atheism, materialism, we've talked about several of these. Part of a cluster, not a complex, a cluster of isms that kind of support the whole scientific rational worldview. And once again, I think naturalism is big and continues to be big. There's hardly anything else. Really need to say, right? There's a big divide between people who think that the world can be explained in terms of natural forces and those who can't. One of the big challenges to naturalism, although ultimately this worldview fits within naturalism, it's just a broader version of it. But one of the big challenges to naturalism that has been introduced philosophically and may be debated scientifically at some point is the notion that we live in a simulation. Right, because there you have a supernature. You have supernatural phenomena, which is whoever the designer and creator of this simulation that we're living in, the things they do. Now that being is not really a supernatural being. The way we think of it is not God in the traditional sense, and you know, doesn't live in a mystical realm. But nature suddenly becomes bigger, and naturalism has to expand to include that. But currently, I think there's a lot of tension between kind of old school naturalists and more, I don't know, open-minded naturalists who will embrace that possibility. And the scary thing is, once you embrace that possibility, it does seem there's a lot of other possibilities, doesn't it?
Yeah. So basically, the old dichotomy, naturalism, supernaturalism, now perhaps naturalism versus, what would you call that?
Like meta-naturalism. Yeah, I don't know.
Something like that. Yeah, absolutely. Which leads, in a way, in an interesting way, to the next ism, which is nihilism, the denial of all reality, extreme skepticism. I mean, I suppose it could be argued that those who believe that we're living in a simulation could be called nihilists. What do you think, Phil?
Well, I would never become one, although I think sometimes that we are living in a simulation. But, you know, we talked last time about defeatism, and it seems to me that this ism and defeatism are similar, that it's hard to recruit people into this one, right? You know, it's like if
– Yeah, well, you know, I just don't care to get involved in it.
Yeah, you know, if your own unfortunate, like, worldview leads you there – there you go. I'm sorry that you ended up there, but did you ever see The Big Lebowski?
But I'm trying to make a connection.
The Germans, they all claim this philosophy, right? They all claim that's what they are. And there's a scene where one of them's passed out in the swimming pool, and And Lebowski says to the big Lebowski's wife, he says, "What's his problem?" And she says, "Oh, he's a nihilist." And he says, "Oh, it must be exhausting, right? Because he's just lying there. He's not doing anything." But you know, there's a scene where they're going, "We believe in nothing," right? It's like, well, how excited can you really get about that? It's a dead end. Like defeatism, it's a dead end. I see it being something that shows up in waves. Every now and then, it becomes really popular to be a goth kid, or you know, to have art student angst, or whatever, you know, whatever the popular thing is that makes you think, yeah, I've been reading Nietzsche and now I'm all into this. But as a big movement or as a major factor, a major player, I don't think so.
Well, you know, it's a little like the anarchist who's, you know, big into that philosophy until somebody comes and steals his stuff, you know.
Exactly.
You know, it turns out that there are things that you believe in, you may, even if you thought otherwise. Okay, nominalism, the doctrine of naming things defines reality. That's interesting. There's, you know, this old belief that if someone knew your name, then they had certain power over you.
Right.
Yeah, that's. I think that was a flavor of nominalism. What do you think, Phil? Does this have any future, any bearing on life, or is Rose by any other name still Rose?
Well, I think that it might. In that we're coming to a better understanding of the relationship between information and matter. Right. We talked about that earlier. The relationship between information and physical reality, and nominalism. The doctrine of naming things is all about the information side of the equation. So this one may pop up again. I mean, it's not one that people spend a lot of time on now, but to the extent that we're going to be looking at and thinking about and trying to understand information a lot better in the future, yeah, I think there's a possibility there. Now, here we've got objectivism, which says the doctrine that all reality is objective. But let's forget that lowercase objectivism, and let's talk about the Ayn Rand variety, right, of objectivism.
Okay, all
right, which I think she would, if she were here, would say is the doctrine that all reality is objective, but it takes on some other things too. It takes on a kind of extreme libertarian creed, extreme
every man for himself kind of thing.
View of self-interest, yeah, but a very positive view of self-interest. I think it gets misrepresented sometimes. If you read a book like The Fountainhead, right? The guy in that book, I can't think of the character's name, Howard Roark. He's a very likable guy. You know, he's self-interested, but he's not against other people, and it's not like he doesn't care about other people. But he is pursuing his own self-interest. It's an interesting. Interesting dichotomy. I don't know if I think there's objectivism appeals to people, especially like young people. You know, it's like your high school.
Yeah.
You're in high school, and then you read Atlas Shrugged, and you think, "Oh, now I understand how the world has to work." Right? You know, kind of thing. But it feels to me mostly it's more like a phase people go through than it is actually something.
And it's funny. It's the same age people tend to go through idealism at the same time.
It is very idealistic. Really, it's kind of a species of that. It's a subspecies of idealism.
I guess so. And of course, I would say that most liberals, for example, liberalism would look at objectivism, Ayn Rand's objectivism, and say, you know, what we got here is Gordon Gekko. You know, someone who is so self-interested that you know, laws don't matter. You know. Certainly, you don't matter. I'll walk right over you to get to my pot of gold. I would say that the smartest objectivists would want to live by the golden rule, with the expectation that others would do the same. You know, and would want to live in a society of people that are self-interested, yes, but would respect the interests of others. If for no other reason but for reciprocity reasons. So anyway,
the big critique people make of Ayn Rand is that there are no children in her novels, right? Right. None of these people have kids because you can't have that purely self-interested view if you have kids, right? People who raise children, you can extend that and say, well, it's really my self-interest and my family, but that's different,
yeah.
Right? I mean, that's actually, you've extended it at that point. You've gone outside yourself to someone else, and it's like, well, if you can make an exception for your kids, there might be other exceptions as well. Yeah. So, I agree with you, Stephen, that where you were going, which is kind of the social contract kind of idea, right? That they're all sort of bringing something to the table. It seems to me that idea probably has more legs than the pure objectivism. But it will be around. People are still going to be reading those books and talking about those ideas for sure.
Oh, forever. Okay, optimism is next. Now, you know, we all have our idea of what optimism is. We believe that things are getting better all the time. We believe that, you know, of all the possible things that could happen, that the thing that's the best will most likely happen. That's glasses half full kind of guy. That is what we think of when we think of optimism. But this is way you define it here is a bit different. Phil, you want to kind of go into that a little bit?
Well, this is the old philosophical optimism, the doctrine that we live in the best of all possible worlds. If you ever read, I think Voltaire wrote it, a book called Candide from the 16th, 17th, 18th century, somewhere in there, probably 18th. Is a bitter satire about philosophical optimism because it was very much that belief. Everything works for the best in the best of all possible worlds. There's a character in the book, he's a philosopher, his name is Dr. Pangloss, and that's what he's always teaching everyone. All his disciples, Candide is one of them at one point, all learn that this is the best of all possible worlds. So no matter how horrible things get, no matter what, terrible things happen, you have to go, oh, well, that's okay. It's for the best. This is the best of all possible worlds. That is philosophical optimism, Panglossian optimism, which I utterly reject. Okay, absolutely reject. When I tag the world transformed with optimism, that is not what I'm thinking about. Okay, at all. To me, that is kind of a species of denial, and it's actually the opposite almost of the true optimism that has helped to drive humanity forward, which is, Stephen, what you were getting at, the idea that there is a better possible outcome than the one we're thinking about right now, right? That
right.
If I look at my circumstances where they are right now, they can be improved, and there are better outcomes probably even than the ones I'm thinking about. And I should continue thinking about the situation, continue working for the best possible outcome. Not that we live in the best possible world, but that there is a best possible world that's achievable. That's real optimism. Okay, that's the way I use the term. And I think that correction in what we mean by optimism is hugely important. It's something that has occurred over the last century or so, and that variety of optimism, I think, is the kind that has the legs to move on into the future. I think because it's ultimately what's gotten us to where we are now. And I think of all the isms, optimism has the brightest future.
And that's only fair, right?
Which seems only right, yes.
That seems only right. Okay, I can't take issue with much of that, Phil, so let's move on to organism. Now organism, would just like a little germ would be an organism, small biological life or whatever. Jeb suggests this, and maybe it could be organismism or maybe biologicalism. But what he's asking us about is there a future for biological life as we know?
Right.
Are we going to be machines, or is there going to be biological life? What do you think, Phil?
Well, I think that that's a really good question. I think there will. I think that that biological organisms will continue to exist. The majority of humanity may eventually move out of that substrate, and we may come to view it as much less central to all existence than we currently do. So to that extent, the future of organism is somewhat diminished. It becomes smaller and becomes less important over time, but it certainly never goes away completely.
I would argue that yes, you're right in much of what you're saying there, Phil. I would say that, for example, to the extent that we are become a space-faring civilization, biological life is just an expensive proposition for moving throughout space. You know, and particularly if you're going to move from one solar system to another, much cheaper would be small probes that would have machine intelligence and could move. A lot smaller amounts of matter could move that and throughout the galaxy. That's true. And so, to the extent that we're spacefaring, I think that's exactly right. That we move away from biological. But you know, if we are terraforming planets and we are gardening whole parts of the galaxy that had formerly been barren, then biological life is even more important, even if we are primarily non-biological. So I think, yes, organism, if that's how you define it, has a bright future.
All right, now we've got 50 minutes left in the show, and Paul in the chat room has asked a great question here. He says, the library gave me the wrong video game. What ism do you have for that? So I'll tell you what, Stephen, I want you to ponder that. And when we get to the end of the show, we'll each say what ism we think best represents Paul's video game conundrum, okay?
All right.
Moving on, connectionism. This is the one that was another one suggested by a listener to the show. This is Monica who suggested this one. And I just grabbed the definition of connectionism off Wikipedia. Actually, the definition was too long, so I took the central principle. Here's what it says on Wikipedia. The central connectionist principle is that mental phenomena can be described by interconnected networks of simple and often uniform units. The form of the connections in the units can vary from model to model. For example, units in the network could represent neurons, and the connections could represent synapses. So obviously, connectionism is very important for us in information technology, specifically very important for us in the development of artificial intelligence. And the notion that interconnected networks of simple uniform units can lead to the kind of complexity that we're looking for in artificial intelligence, I think probably maps very closely to our understanding of how the brain works, right? We've got these really simple structures that generate the complexity that's required to give us the intelligence that we have. I think it goes without saying that connectionism is a really important concept and one that we're going to be relying on quite heavily as we move into a future where artificial intelligence is going to be a much bigger part of our lives.
Absolutely, absolutely. I found it interesting in the movie Avatar. In that particular world that is described in that movie, a beautiful movie, by the way. I mean, it just physically stunning. But I mean, that world, they go beyond like the Gaia principle that some environmentalists have adopted, and their world is actually so interconnected with networks of biological intelligence or whatever that the planet itself is sentient. I think that was an interesting idea, and I like the way that played out. So for entirely different reasons than what you mentioned, Phil, I think that connectionism obviously is an important idea, and it's being used in a lot of different ways, and that was just another.
Well, and what you just said, Stephen, ties in very closely to panpsychism, our next one, the theory that all nature, has a psychic side, has some level of consciousness, some level of awareness. This sounds like kookyville to me, okay, this idea, or at least it did a while back. But, I've been doing some reading, and there's more to it than meets the eye. There are some reasons to believe that this might actually be the case. And we had Ben Goertzel and, who was our other guest that night? David Pierce, on talking about the hard problem of consciousness and some related issues. And panpsychism came up. And neither one of them would completely refute the possibility that there could be something to this. So I think that speaks for itself. If you've got these major transients,
for a while, it's interesting. You know, even the Kurzweil idea that we're moving from one substrate where intelligence is adopted into nature in different ways. First, it wasn't chemistry first, was it? It's first, space time itself, and then chemistry, and then biology, and then intelligence within minds, and now intelligence within machines. Even that, there's almost this built-in idea, isn't there, Phil, that that there's some structure within the universe that sort of is wanting this, is pushing this in a way. Well, you can definitely go down that road until it just gets weird and kind of kooky. But there, like you say, some awfully smart guys that spend a lot of time thinking about these things won't discount it completely. So there you are.
Yes, if the entire material world is sort of thinking about things, that's I don't know. It makes you stop and think.
Yeah.
Okay.
In some ways, it almost leads into the next one in a way. Panspermatism.
Panspermatism, which we all know as panspermia, but if we say panspermia, it's not an ism, so we have to.
And this is the idea that life is common, or at least the building blocks of life common, and that it's seeded throughout the galaxy.
Yeah, specifically that life here started from someplace else, that we got seeded from elsewhere. I think we'll know eventually. That's one of those things. This one will be,
Proven or disproven?
Could it be disproven? That's the problem. It could only be proven, right? Because if we never know, we'll never know for sure exactly how life started, or will we? I don't know. Maybe we will. Maybe we'll know exactly how it started here, and therefore that will discount any possibility of panspermia. But it seems to me more likely that we'll find out that, yes, panspermia occurred and that life started elsewhere. If I was betting on something, I would say that it's right. What do you think?
And certainly the building blocks of life, if not life itself, came from elsewhere. Amino acids.
Right.
I don't think there's even any controversy that that they can be found throughout the solar system. There's lots of building blocks of life that are throughout at least this solar system and probably elsewhere as well. So, it depends on how you define it. If you actually think that there was life maybe developed on Mars first and historized.
A meteor hit and sent some stuff here.
Blew these germs into the solar system, and they seeded life here. I think you're right. I think we will know one way or another, or have a pretty good idea one way or another on at least that. I would say within a generation. So.
I think so. Okay, next one's pantheism. We're on pantheism, not pessimism yet. Pantheism, the belief that the universe is God. I think we covered this with cosmism last time, so we'll move on to pessimism.
Yeah.
Okay, the doctrine that the universe is essentially evil, I think, is an overstatement of how pessimism plays out today. Basically, it's today pessimism takes the form that people are evil, that people are bad, and that we're going to make bad things happen. The universe, generally, by pessimistic people, is viewed as okay, like the world is good, nature is good, but people are bad. So it takes different forms over time, and that's interesting because when I go back to my definition of optimism, which derives from the human imperative, it kind of starts with the assumption that people are at least trying to be good. We're trying to do good things, and by and large, we succeed in doing good things. So the doctrine that people are essentially evil, that they're bad, I think this one has really taken hold in certain quarters, and it's not going anywhere. I think people are going to hold on to that idea for some time to come.
I think as long as there are bad people.
There's always going to be plenty of good examples.
They'll always be pointed to as examples. Well, that's how everybody is. A lot of times people that are pessimistic would never identify themselves as pessimists. They would call themselves realists and say that we are completely naive. we optimists. And, you know, don't you see that the world is really, you know, a depressing kind of place? And I would just say, well, you're just not looking at the same things I'm looking at. And so there you are. Next is positivism.
Let's cluster these next two because this is interesting. Positivism is the doctrine that which is not observable is not knowable, and pragmatism is that the truth of a concept is to be evaluated by its practical consequences for human affairs. So almost two sides of the same coin here, right? In fact, I'm going to just go ahead and subsume positivism under pragmatism because it seems to me that that's the bigger of the two. Basically, the idea that the ends justify the means, right? You know, what we're looking at is the bottom line, how things work out, and the rest of it is just kind of a lot of noise. I'll tell you what, that idea it operates best under the covers. People are extremely pragmatic, but they dress it up, right? They put ideology all over their pragmatism, and the pragmatism only comes out, I think, when push comes to shove, by and large. So I think, kind of disguised like that, pragmatism probably has a pretty bright future. As a literal, you know, people saying, "Look, I don't care about anything else. These are the things I want to make happen, and let's do it." I don't know. I don't know how much of that we'll see. It seems like people are pretty good at giving great rationales for why they want to do. What do you think, Stephen?
I think that we'll have pragmatists, I'm just gonna agree with you, Phil, and ask to move on. I think that there's not much I can add to that.
Okay. Yeah, I think we'll have a lot of pragmatists. I don't think many of them will claim to be pragmatists. That's my only exception. Predestinarianism.
Well, I'm just move on. Okay.
Very good. Yeah, it gets us closer to the end of the show. The belief that whatever is to happen is already fixed, and we talked about this under a different ism last time, and I can't remember what it was, but it was fatalism or something.
I think it was fatalism. Yeah.
Yeah. But basically, the belief that whatever is to happen is already fixed. I think yes. There are people who claim to believe that, but they live their lives as though they don't believe that. It's kind of like pragmatism, actually. they dress it up. They dress it up in something else. So I think on those terms, yes, it will continue. People will claim that we have no choice in the matter, that everything is bound to play out a certain way. But then they'll try to persuade you that you should believe that, right? Or they'll try to get you to change your ways when apparently we don't have any choice.
It's related, I think, to the concept of Calvinists within the Christian faith. Those who are going to become Christians are already known by God, and therefore, we really don't have much choice in the matter.
They're the elect. That's right.
Yeah, there's the elect, and I've always kind of thought that the joke is who's what's the poorest person in the world is a Presbyterian missionary,
the Calvinist missionary, and yet they have them, you know, they do it. It's because somebody has to throw the elect switch. I don't know. I'm not sure how that works, right?
It's odd.
Or perhaps you had no choice. It was your destiny to be a Calvinist missionary.
Your destiny was to be a Calvinistic missionary. Anyway, it's interesting. I would say that we are destined to have predestinalism for a while. So
people will continue to hold that up. How about probabilism? Okay. The belief that knowledge is always probable, but never absolute. I think in the ever since quantum mechanics, that we've all been probabilist at best, right? That's kind of a best case scenario for how well we can understand the universe. I think that's a fundamentalism these days, and it's not going anywhere.
What is the compensator that's used in the Star Trek universe for the transporter? I forget.
What is it?
It's not the Higgs compensator. Whatever. It's the idea that there's this idea that you can know the speed of a particle. You can know the motion of a particle. But you can't, and you can know the position of a particle, but you can't know all, and therefore how in the world.
Yeah, it's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, right?
Heisenberg compensator. That's what it's called.
Right.
Star Trek universe. And the joke is, how does that work? Very well, thank you. And they move on. The Star Trek guys want to move on. The ones who want to, we don't quite know how that would work, but probabilism is kind of accepted science now. So,
we're all probabilists and we don't argue about it much. Okay, progressivism is our next one. I don't have a definition listed there because there are so many possible ones. But we've already talked about liberalism, and progressivism is used as a synonym for liberalism. It'll be like, okay, goodbye-ism. We'll see you next week-ism by the time we get to the end of the show-ism. Progressivism, as it's understood, is, or at least has been tied to a particular political stripe in the U.S. currently, and it's the more left of center, the more social responsibility, having the government step in and do things kind of view. I think that flavor of progressivism continues. That it's going to have a large following. It's going to carry on as it always has. That conservatism and liberalism, I think, as I said last time, will look a little different in the future. But they'll both be there and they'll both be strong. But I want to use the term differently. And when I talk about progressivism, I mean the belief in progress. Okay, and that's that's like the human imperative idea, the belief or the law of accelerating returns, the belief that we're actually getting somewhere. I think that flavor of progressivism goes back to the late 19th century. It got a hold of people's heads then. It was a very popular way of looking at the world for a while. World War I came along, and it kind of jaded people on progressivism.
We failed to that, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and then World War II came along, and then it was pretty much forgotten. But if you can distance yourself from those horrible, horrible things, the basic idea is sound. And I think it's made a tremendous comeback over the last decade or so, and it's going to be a very important ism in the future, true progressivism, the belief in human progress.
That's how I would define it, and I would classify myself as one, although most people would look at my politics and say I'm right of center. We actually had a guest one time, Phil. I believe I've mentioned this before, who defined what anyone who thinks and values these ideas that we talk about. He called these are techno progressives, and he argued that in order to be a techno progressive, you have to be progressive in the left wing political sense.
I think he's got it exactly wrong.
I think that what we're talking about is actually post-political or beyond politics. And
because when I use the word, I really mean progress, okay? The problem is a lot of the people who call themselves progressive don't actually believe in progress. If anything, they're a little bit opposed to it. They're not big advocates of technology. Often they're a little bit Luddite or renunciationist around certain aspects of technology, and their solutions to things are usually to stop developing and stop moving forward so we can protect the environment, stop moving forward so we can, there'll be more for other people. However the argument is framed, it's not a damn the torpedoes, full steam ahead, progress kind of agenda that a lot of progressives have. So I think that individual, and I don't remember who said that. I think he had it. Probably he had it exactly wrong. I think that real progressivism is the belief that we're getting somewhere. And if you don't have that belief, I think you've hijacked the word, frankly.
No.
But we're not supposed to be ideological about this.
Word hijacking happens. The next one is racism, the belief that race is the primary determinant of human capacities, favoring one's own race over that of others, perhaps. I suppose that you could be a racist and favor other races over your own, I suppose.
That'd be pretty lame.
Yeah, it was kind of, that's kind of a down. It would be a downer way to be a racist if there's an up way to be a racist. But it's we've had racists since the dawn of time, Bill. I mean,
I would love to think that racism is going. I'd love to think it's going away. I don't think it's going anywhere. I think it's whack-a-mole with racism. It just, you know, we beat it down in one area and it pops up. It pops up in another area. Although, having said that, you know, I said I think nationalism is on the wane. If nationalism can wane, then certainly racism can too. Ultimately, that we can put it away.
Well, and I think so. And I want to say one thing about this that might be slightly,
controversial. Go, Stephen. What do you got?
Slightly controversial. It's the N-word's been put away. You know, I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you a white person that I know that uses it readily in conversation.
Right.
It doesn't happen. And then you got Charlie Rangel in Congress talking about crackers.
it's whack-a-mole, right? Yeah, you know.
It's whack-a-mole. Give me a break, Charles Rangel. You know.
Stephen, let me follow you down the rabbit hole, okay? Because I was thinking about this too. I was listening to Sirius Radio on my car earlier today. As I was driving, I had on Comedy Central, and a comic came on. He's clearly a black guy, and he went on this rant about white people. You know, white people do this, they do this, they do this. And partly because it wasn't particularly funny, which, you know, is the downfall of anything like that. Anyhow, you know, it sounded more like he was mad than anything else. It really struck me. It was like, well, dude, just back off, all right? You know, leave me alone. You know, I'm just trying to get some gas in my car. Why are you beating up on me? I think you make a good point, and it goes back to the whack-a-mole idea, right? It does seem that that when we get rid of it one place, it shows up someplace else, but maybe not forever. It doesn't have to be whack-a-mole.
I think
forever.
At least we have to have the courage to whack that mole, though. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If we see racism, I think we should call it that. You know, if it's the redneck using the N-word, absolutely, we all agree that's racist. But it's just as racist when it's applied to other groups. So
I think the argument would be that it's not just language; it's the social structures. It's how society distributes power, economic power, how people are treated, all that kind of thing. But I really do think that it's whack-a-mole in all those forms. I honestly do. I think that we have these discussions about white privilege these days, and without going, you know, that would be a rabbit hole that we just don't have time for, even in a 90-minute show, to go down. I think that those concepts, the idea that that racism is inherent, that it's built in. It's like we have to step back and just say, what if we just don't have that idea so strongly anymore, right? What if we just don't make that the big deal anymore? We all have to do that.
I think a good way to fight racism is to make sure that you're having lots of contacts with people that are different from yourself.
Yeah.
And the more you get to know people that are different from yourself, the harder it is to hate people that are different from yourself. My best friends are white. If you really do have friends that are, you know, a different race than you, I mean, you become blind to those characteristics that people have divided the world up into. It's just a better way to live.
I agree.
Allowing everybody.
When you're friends with people, when you work with them, when you have even just casual exchanges with them, that's one of the great things that technology has enabled for us, is that we're able to connect with so many more people than we could in the past. And we can get to know people who are really different from us. And something I would encourage everyone to do is to use the technology that we use, the social technology we have, to get to know people who are really different, not just racially, but ideologically. Yeah. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah.
Make some friends from the other side of the other side of the political spectrum. It's a very eye-opening experience when you suddenly really care about somebody who has that view that you just can't stand. It really humanizes the whole thing. Okay, we're running out of time. We got to keep moving here. Rationalism.
Yeah, that was a good rabbit hole, though. That was a great rabbit hole.
We find the best ones. The belief that reason is the fundamental source of knowledge. You know what? We have discussed this under different guises, so we're going to say bright future for rationalism. Realism, the doctrine that objects of cognition are real. Well, that's not what people mean when they say realism. They mean that they're not going to be too negative, they're not going to be too positive, they're not going to be swayed by a lot of crazy ideas. They're just going to look at the world as it really, really is, kind of the lowercase objectivism. You know what? I don't think realism is nearly as popular as people think it is. Everyone describes it kind of like pragmatism, which hides itself. People claim to be realists, but really they're mostly deeply attached to kind of their biases and their favorite fantasies about how the world is going to work out. I think that realism is something that we have yet to truly aspire to, and that perhaps we might see some actual realism in the future. It'd be nice if we do.
Okay, and to that extent, I think it has a bright future. We might be realer realists in the future than we are now. Reductionism, the belief that the complex phenomena are reducible to simple ones. This has been the march of science in a way, hasn't it, Phil?
Yes.
To some extent, I think there will be a lot more to learn as we look at the world holistically. We've learned about the human body by looking at smaller and smaller parts of it. Now, it'd be good to know how these parts work together in a holistic way. I think would teach us even more. Not to say that reductionism is over. I'm just saying that maybe we can. Holistic thinking can kind of.
I think it will challenge reductionism. Yes, yeah. I think that reductionism is due for some challenging. And to your point, it continues to be a technique that's extremely important for breaking the world down and understanding it. But we might find that it's useful but not complete. It's not the only way of looking at things, and that we have to add something, another point of view to kind of triangulate to make the world make a little more sense. Relativism, the view that truth and value are relative to an observer or group of observers. This is interesting because you hear about, you know, moral relativism. The idea that my good and you're bad, and, you know, people are relative about that rather than objective about it. To me, it feels like we're less relativistic than we used to be. And maybe that's because we've become more ideological over the last few years, that maybe relativism was bigger 10 or 15 years ago than it is today. And that's just a feeling. I don't have any hard data to back that up, but that's just kind of a feeling that I have. And I think that if that's true, that trend is likely to continue.
Your feelings, Phil, but you know, my feelings are going to be different on this.
I look at this from a different point of view, if you see what I'm saying.
I'm coming from a different place on relativism. I would say that moral relativism continues to be on the march. I don't particularly like that way of looking at the world. I like there to be, you know, absolute goods. That some things are just absolutely wrong all the time. But I feel like that worldview has been under attack. And I would say that relativism in that way does have a it will be with us. It'll be with us for the foreseeable future.
Okay, well, there you go. There's relativism in its finest, because from where I sit, I think it's on the wane. You think it's growing. So there you go. Pick your viewpoint. Okay, romanticism, defined here as belief in sentimental feeling in artistic expression. I don't like that definition of romanticism. I see it as a much broader kind of intellectualized mysticism that takes on an aesthetic value. I am absolutely 100% romantic myself. I think that science fiction derives from the romantic movement. Fantasy all comes from the romantic movement. Just the belief that there's a little bit of magic in the world is romanticism. Yeah. And I think that it's on hard times. I think that romanticism has been pretty much beaten out of most people at this point, to our detriment. And I hope it makes a comeback, but I don't see a lot of reason to believe that it's going to. But I'm going to remain a hopeful romantic for the rest of my life, whatever happens.
Yeah, I can tell you, the Star Trek way of looking at the world. Speaking of sci-fi, science fiction, mm-hmm. Which is definitely romanticism, or even Star Wars. And then on the if you like your sci-fi a little less that way, you might think of the current or the latest iteration of Battlestar Galactica, very gritty, very naturalistic is the opposite side of that coin. I think it's the Call of the Wild is an example of a naturalistic, non-romantic type literature. I think romanticism has taken a beating, but we can be romantic about being the last. Last people to believe in romanticism. So,
That is kind of a romantic notion, right? We're the final few.
Last scholars and last. We're the fine.
But you know what I mean? It's like when I was a kid, even like the environmental movement was very kind of romantic, and now the environmental movement is very technical. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everything that used to be romanticized, it seems to me, it isn't anymore, and I think that's too bad. Okay, scientism, a belief that methods of science are universally applicable, has won. No one disagrees with this, I think, that anyone who likes science believes in scientism. In fact, we don't even have that word. You're just a scientist, right? okay, here's a good one. Number 90. We're getting to we're kind of into the after hours here on World Transform, so let's talk about centralism.
go to bed. It's time for the adults to talk here.
That's right. The movies that come on later on the cable channels.
Yeah.
A form of hedonism that emphasizes the pleasures of the senses or of the body as opposed to the pleasures of the mind. Now, I believe I went ahead and included this one because we'd already talked about hedonism, and this is what most people mean when they say hedonism. And we made the distinction last time about a kind of a broader, more embracing hedonism that talks about ending animal suffering and things like that. This sensualism, this is actually what when people use the term hedonism, they're usually thinking about is this just kind of emphasis on feeling good, right? And I think along with narcissism and solipsism, sensualism has a fantastic future. I think that technology is moving us in a direction that enables people to indulge that, and they're going to in a big way. That's my prediction.
Yeah. Who likes to feel otherwise? You can always get a big group up to for a sensual experience, but you're going to have trouble, with the opposite or with nihilism. It's sort of like the opposite of nihilism in that way. Yeah, it has a natural draw to it, and I think that were it not for sensualism, we wouldn't have a drug problem, for example.
Having said that, I think it does take a hard form. It takes a brutal kind of a form these days because you see things like these, these tough mudder races, the mud race challenge, the whole thing is like just to go endure this thing and they're going to hit you and shock you and, throw you down in the mud and you're going to get through it and show that you did it. I think in a weird way, that's kind of a form of this. But
and even though you think, well, that's not pleasant at all. Well, the people who do it get some sense of pleasure
they're
out of it.
They're getting some big high out of it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, they're getting it. Yeah, they're getting an endorphin rush. I guarantee it. Even though it's not sitting on the beach with a pina colada, but it's there's something going on there that's very sensual. Okay.
Yeah, because I look at those and I go, no, I'll just stay home and stub my toe, right? I'll just stub the hell out of my toe and save myself a lot of trouble.
People get addicted to tattoos, you know? I mean, tattoos all over the body and piercings and everything. What in the world went on through your brain to get into that? Well, I promise you, there's
something that feels good there. You're right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Skepticism,
absolutely.
The doctrine that true knowledge is always uncertain. And it seems to me we've already covered this with probabilism. It's just the other side of that coin. So we can agree that I think skepticism in that sense continues to be big. There's also the kind of skeptical movement, the people who are always talking about things are woo, right? The followers of what's his name, the magician, the Amazing Randy, right?
The
people who are just kind of the philosophical skeptics. They're just they're skeptical about certain things, say UFOs and all that kind of stuff. I think that movement as a movement is probably going to continue to gain ground because it falls in line with atheism and materialism and a lot of the rest of the things. Okay, socialism, the doctrine of centralized state control of wealth and property. What do you think, Stephen?
Well, you know, socialism, I think it has a bright future in one way, okay? And here's why. You know, if technology marches to the point that machines basically are able to do all of our jobs better than we can do them, okay? And we're all without work. Then how do we live? Well, there's going to have to be some sort of distribution of wealth. We could live in a vastly wealthy world because, you know, we have tireless machines producing wealth for us. Well, how does that get distributed? Well, one way is from some sort of centralized control of wealth and property. So socialism could have a bright future there. On the other hand, the power of individuals. As individuals empowered by technology would seem to be growing by leaps and bounds, which is sort of anti-socialistic. So,
well, not really. I mean, the thing is, socialism doesn't necessarily say that individuals don't get liberty, right? It just has always had to contradict that to a certain extent because it's like taking things away from people, right? But if there's just this vast abundance of everything and you've got some centralized, you know, I always think of it as being kind of like the adhocracy in Cory Doctorow's novels, distributing everything, that may not have to interfere with people's personal lives the way it used to. So to me, the big difference between socialism and capitalism, the big like personal freedom differences and the notions around personal property and all these kind of big ideological barriers that stood between those two ideas become much different, much less significant in a post-scarcity world. And that's where I think we might have capitalism and socialism living side by side, and we won't even worry about it. We'll think, okay, well, look, they go. It's like peanut butter and chocolate. They go great together.
Well, it's a sort of future that's not going to make either those on the far right or the far left happy to contemplate. It's not going to be quite the dream of either. I think we'll all be surprised. But
nobody gets to win, right? That would irritate.
That's right. It's going to be a tie. I think there'll be eternal arguments over how we got to that point. Was it centralized control or was it the freedom of the individual?
No matter what, even if we have a committee handing everything out for free, and people have completely free markets, and they're both coexisting, people will still be arguing about this stuff, right? There will still be huge, philosophical debates about this stuff. Okay, solipsism, the theory that self-existence is the only certainty. And
please pronounce that word again.
Solipsism.
Thank you. I can never pronounce that word. Yeah.
Yeah. So
therefore,
basically,
I don't think that word exists because I'm the only real reality in this universe.
I mean that's what it comes down to is, you can actually hold that that point of view. And if we end up in simuality, perhaps there will be a simualism, ultimately, a newism to contend with. If we end up in simuality, people will be free to be a lot more solipsistic than they've been in the past. As I've said, they'll be able to be more sensualistic, more narcissistic than they've been in the past. I think that technology is a big enabler of solipsism, and it's got a, unfortunately, I think to some extent, a very bright future. I worry about how internally wrapped up in themselves lives some people's lives are going to become ultimately. But then come to think of it, even without the technology, a lot of people live that way. So maybe it's nothing to worry about.
I have met people, Phil, that really believe, have actually said things that may, really their feelings, they felt like that, no one really felt the world the way they do.
Yeah.
I would say that the typical a teenager, going through the drama of the teenage years, believes
yes.
that no one has ever felt the way they feel about the things that they're going through, and no one's
right.
This is a new, falling in love with that girl or that guy or whatever is, no one's ever felt this way about anybody. This is a new thing in the universe. Well, you get a little older and you realize, there's very little that we experience as individuals that hadn't been experienced by others, and their feelings and their reality is just as important to them as ours is to us. And so I think maturity sort of combats solipsism.
I think so. I think that's one of those. It's one of those philosophies that that works great when you're younger. Or when you don't quite have the perspective, but that later you maybe come to regret a bit. Okay, we got to move very quickly now. Spiritualism, the belief that nothing is real except the soul or spirit, will continue. It will still exist. It's probably going to be continually increasingly marginalized as time goes forward. Stoicism, the belief in indifference to pleasure or pain, I think has very little future. People are, if anything, a lot more sensitive to those things than they used to be, and are only going to become more so. So I don't think we'll see a lot of Stoics, but there might be a few people who, just to be different, take that on. So it doesn't go away completely. How about subjectivism?
I think a lot of people who claim to be Stoics are really centralists that like, the rougher side of sensualism or whatever.
You're right. Absolutely.
They claim to be Stoics, but they're not really. Okay. So
yeah, they're getting a little thrill out of denying themselves things. Exactly. Subjectivism, the doctrine that all knowledge is subjective. Again, I think we've probably covered this.
Relativism is very close to this.
Yeah. And I think that, I think it actually when you stated it as subjectivism, I'm on board with you now, Stephen. So relatively, I've changed my position, because now I think subjectivism will probably be much more important in the future. Although I think relativism has kind of slid. Although the difference is, relativism to me seems to be focused on a group of people, whereas subjectivism is on the individual. Right, the individual subjective experience, and I think that our focus on that is only going to be bigger. Utopianism, any view of societal or political relations that advocates the creation of a perfect society. We know the truth about utopias. We've explained it many times on this program. Utopias are always relative, right? This is one of the good uses of relativism, is to understand that you never get to the real utopia. They're always like a mirage off in the distance. And I think utopianism will continue to be very popular and will continue to be thwarted by every new development of the future. We'll never get to utopia, so that'll always leave people free to be utopians if they choose to be so. Okay, I'm going to do utilitarianism and vitalism before we get to our last one. Utilitarianism, the belief that the utility of actions determines more value, pretty much pragmatism all over again, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, although when you state it as utilitarianism, I'm not as hard on it. Now, why is that? That's interesting. to me, I view pragmatism as something a bit cynical, and utilitarianism, to me, I view as like a philosophically sound approach. Well, if we had more time, we'd get into what's wrong with me that I look at the world that way. Next comes vitalism, the doctrine that there's a vital force behind life. Once again, this is something that has been all but disproved by, unlike atomism, which is true, right? We can just say, yes, that is absolutely true. Vitalism has not completely been disproved, but it's been all but disproved. But there's still we were talking about the difference between reductionism and holism. There's still a case for vitalism to be made from the holistic argument, and I think we'll hear more from vitalism in the future. I'm not saying it's ever going to win out or become predominant, but I don't think it's going to disappear completely. So finally, the 100th ism, the one we put at the very bottom of the list, transhumanism. Stephen, what do you think? What's the future for transhumanism?
Okay, understand transhumanism. I think it's important to understand what humanism is. Humanism is placing an importance on humanity, on people, and as opposed to what? What else could be important besides people? Well, ideology. This is saying that people are actually more important than that. Well, transhumanism says that people would have the right to improve their circumstances beyond what is considered actually possible with human bodies or human minds or human circumstances. It is the freedom to move forward beyond what our limits are today, be they physical, mental, or whatever, or geographical. We can live throughout the solar system, perhaps. I think it's got a bright, bright future, Phil, because, once people have the power to do things, they will do these things. That's just been the history of humanity. Before there were cars, people might have badmouthed the idea of traveling at 45, 50, 60 miles an hour. But once cars entered the world, it seems like the entire world adopted them in pretty short order. And I would say that would be the same with other technologies that broaden our abilities, broaden our capabilities. What do you think, Phil?
I couldn't agree more. As our friend PJ Manny says, we've always been transhuman. That humanity is a process of constant process of transcending itself. That we're always trying to move to that next step.
I would suggest to you, Phil, that a good dividing line between humanity and pre-humanity would have been that point at which those creatures, those people, once they crossed that line, decided that to heck with this freezing all the time, let's use some fire, let's use some tools,
mm-hmm.
I'm tired of gnawing through the hide to get to the meat. Why don't we cut it with a sharp rock? Once we started improving our circumstances, I think that's a good point at which you could argue we became human to begin with. So transhuman is just a continuation of that same process by other means.
Yeah, I agree. We were at the Museum of Science and Nature. It used to be called the Denver Museum of Natural History the other day. My 4-year-old daughter and I, and we were looking at a diorama that has Lucy, the Australopithecus there, and she's life-sized, full-sized, yeah. And about the same size as my daughter, actually. And she's looking at her.
People.
Yeah, they were little. And she says, she had two questions about her. She said, well, is she nice? And I said, yeah, I'm sure she's nice. And she said, is she a monkey? And I said, no, sweetie, she's human. She was on her way to becoming us. And it's that journey out of the trees, that decision that we're not going to be chimps anymore. We're going to be something else. We're going to build fire. We're going to, we're going to live in the caves, that has brought us here.
That is such a neat question. How old is your daughter?
4.
I don't think that there's a better, more fundamental question she could have asked about Lucy than that. Is she a monkey? Well, that's there was a point at which we ceased being animals and became people, and
it's a really profound question.
We will forever argue about when that took place.
Exactly. Well, we're out of time, so I have to quickly say, Paul, the ism that came into play there was predestinarianism. You were always destined to get that game, and it's the right game for you. So enjoy that. Stephen, what's our music?
I could say, you know, poo happens ism. sometimes bad things happen, my friend. And I hope that you learn to love that game. All right. But anyway.
So true.
The music tonight, Phil, is House Party at Arkham Asylum by The Funk.
Fantastic. All right, everybody will have to listen to the archive because we're not going to have time for this whole righteous House Party at Arkham Asylum. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thanks, everybody, for sticking with us for 3 whole hours of isms. We'll be back at the regular time on Wednesday night next week. Thanks for being part of The World Transformed. And until next time, live to see it.